All right, good evening. Welcome to the May 2016 meeting of the Health Commission. Welcome, visitors. First order of business will be approval of the minutes from our last meeting of April 11th. The minutes were mailed out. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? There being none, the minutes will stand as mailed out and be printed on our website. Next is public comment, and this is the time when anyone who has something to say that is not on our agenda may come forward to the podium and speak for 3 minutes. So is there any public comment this evening? When you come forward, please state your name. Is there a button to push?
I don't know.
Speak?
Is that better?
No. You want me to try that one?
There we go.
Oh, is that better? Well, I'll just be loud. Hi.
No, we can hear you now.
My name is Rochelle Todi. I'm a Napomo Mesa resident and co-founder of the Concerned Citizens for Clean Air. And I would like to talk with you about the particulate matter pollution problem and protecting the public health. I submitted a letter this morning, which I think you received, with some attachments, and I gave hard copies to your recorder here, as well as the South County Air Quality brochure, which was developed in 2012 and mailed out to some residents on the Mesa, and then graphs of the control site monitor versus the CDF and Mesa 2 monitor. Did you pass those out?
Yes,
you did? Okay, great. So the reason that I'm here was stated in the letter. We would like to have the Public Health Commission become involved again in helping solve this problem. And people that live on the Napomo Mesa are concerned about the exposure levels. And as you see in that chart, now that a control site monitor was put in last July, we can clearly see our exposure and how much higher it is than what the background level would be. Since 2010, when this commission wrote a letter, there's been a dust rule that was passed and then tied up in court. And as of right now, it's an active rule, along with the nuisance rule, which the APCD also has. But there is a lack of enforcement of those, so we're concerned about that. There are cost-effective solutions to the dust problem, but more expensive solutions are being pursued over and over again. It's been 3 years now of wind fences and hay bales. And residents feel there's no sense of urgency. There's a feeling that, you know, if you don't live in this dust plume, it's someone else's problem. What I would like to ask for the commission, these are some ideas for things that you might do, is place an agenda item on your next month's meeting where we can further discuss the progress, the barriers, the solutions to this problem. If you are able to request an evaluation of our 8-hour exposure levels, which are detailed in that letter, they're much higher than what the OSHA standards are going to be next month for crystalline silica exposure. And also, the Coastal Commission is having a meeting in August to review the how the permit for this park is being managed. And it would be great if the Health Commission could write a letter to the Coastal Commission and ask for their assistance. They're tasked with helping manage this park.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm Rosemary Nelson, a resident of Napomo. I'm here tonight to express my concern about the high level of air pollution on the Napomo Mesa. When we moved here about 3 years ago, we knew that the dust blowing from the dunes was an issue. We were also told there were solutions to the problem and steps put in place to remediate the problem. Shockingly, this has not been the case. And what is more, the pollution that we understood existed is actually much worse than we ever imagined. We now realize that the Air Quality Index reports showing PM10 and PM2.5 in the moderate range do not tell the whole story. These data are on average for a 24-hour period, which includes about 15 hours when there's little or no OHV activity on the dunes. And the AQI erroneously includes data from a monitor outside the dust plume. In fact, the air we breathe during the daytime hours when we are outdoors is frequently in the unhealthy range. According to the APCD site, everyone will experience health effects at this level of pollution. We need your help. Please do not ignore this serious health problem. We now have on some days the most polluted air in the country. And the reality is that the negative health effects are cumulative. So the longer we are exposed, the more serious the consequences. This is not an issue to be weighed against the prospect of economic gain from recreation activity. Our health and well-being is at stake. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Mike Young. I'm a resident of the Napomo Mesa as well. I'd like to make 5 points regarding the dangerous silica dust emanating from the Oceano Dunes, as this is a health-related land use issue, which is within your sphere of influence, as I understand it. First, as far back as 2010, you took a firm stand that revegetation should be done for at least part of the dunes. Alas, your letter calling for immediate steps to address the public health problem in the Napomo Mesa has been effectively ignored. Second, the so-called buffer area that includes Pismo State Beach, the mouth of the Oro Grande Creek, Pismo Dunes Natural Preserve, the La Grande Track, which importantly is county-owned land, are routinely traversed and damaged by vehicles going to and from the SVRA, and worse, are allowed to be traversed by off-road vehicles that trample the dunes and its vegetation at will. This makes a mockery of the letter and spirit of a buffer zone. And still, the county does nothing on land it owns to prevent this abuse. Third, the failure of the county to preserve and protect and secure the land and biological resources it owns on behalf of all the citizens of the county is either conscious and willful or ignorant and foolhardy. Either way, the county of San Luis Obispo is guilty of acts of omission and as such harms the health, safety, and welfare of people of Mesa and all who visit. Fourth, the palliative measures that have been taken since 2010 were just for show. Fences and hay bales are helpful in reducing blowing and drifting snow, but do little to reduce blowing sand, but most importantly, do nothing to prevent vehicular travel over the La Grande Track and nothing to reduce the dangerous PM10 and PM2.5 silica dust. Crystalline silica, aka sand, is not the same as silica dust, an exceedingly hazardous substance, as you certainly know. Fifth, and lastly, by acts of omission, the county has also allowed what in economics is called a negative externality, where neither the trespassers on the La Grande Track nor the county that owns it have to pay the full cost of their use and decisions. The real costs of the county's acts of omission are borne entirely by the citizens, particularly those on the Mesa. Therefore, to redress some of this economic imbalance, I will petition for a substantial reduction in real property taxes in this coming year, and in following years as well, if nothing happens, and will circulate that petition to other members on the Mesa. It's hard to put a price tag on the damage to our health and life, but I can certainly document the damage to our property values. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any other public comment? Well, thank you for being here, those who made a public comment. As you probably know, we are not allowed to discuss anything that is not on our agenda. So we will, at the end of this meeting, talk about agendizing the item, and certainly you'll know about that. Thank you again. Okay, we'll move on to the first item on our agenda that is for educational purposes, and that is an overview of the veterans' services in our county, and Commissioner Grantham will introduce our speakers.
Thank you very much. This is a nice night. Really happy to have the veterans represented tonight. And our first speaker is Mike Young, who's the team leader at the San Luis Veterans Center.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to be here tonight. I thank the commission for hearing me out for a few minutes, and thank Mrs. Grantham for the invitation. The San Luis Obispo Vet Center came online in 2010. In that same year, the Congress and Secretary of Veterans Affairs authorized 28 new vet centers nationwide, and only one in California, and we were it. Prior to the vet center coming online here in San Luis Obispo, the nearest vet center to our county was in Ventura to the south, and in Santa Cruz to the north, and then in Fresno to the east. So there was a big area that was being underserved in terms of vet center services. The Vet Center program has been around since 1979 and was the result of Vietnam veterans feeling as though they weren't being adequately served in terms of their unique healthcare needs after they returned home from war. And so now there are 300 vet centers nationwide. And the program first started really as an outreach type of project, and it is morphed now into a very large-scale readjustment counseling service. I think I have some slides that we can look at, maybe. Okay, there we go. So the Vet Center program was started by Vietnam vets, and it originally started as kind of a peer support group, and it's professionalized over the years to include licensed mental health providers from various disciplines, psychology, social work, marriage and family therapy. We have other counseling professions as well. And so the Vet Center program is really designed to meet the readjustment needs of a certain category of veterans. We're part of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, but we're a specialized program. Part of what we provide that is a little bit different than the larger VA is we have a completely different system of record for healthcare. So veterans can come in and feel as though their confidentiality is protected, and we don't release any information without their consent unless there's some sort of emergent need. And that's very helpful for some of our local veterans, especially in small communities that are concerned about, if I go and seek treatment, what kind of effect may it have on my job, if a veteran is still active in the Guard or Reserve. And in the Vet Center program, we're able to see active duty members as well. There's, of course, a lot of stigma around military members seeking treatment for issues such as post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury. And so we'd like to think that by offering that higher level of confidentiality that we're going to get more people actually coming in that need it. Vet centers are pretty small teams as compared to what you might see at a VA clinic or at a medical center. And so typically we have a vet center director or team leader, an office manager, an outreach worker, and then counseling staff. We've also, at our particular vet center, have had a veteran advocate in the past. And we're going to be hiring another veteran advocate to help us with some of our higher risk clients to just make sure that that we're keeping on top of everything that they may need. And in the Vet Center program, about 80% of our staff are veterans themselves. And so we try and hire veterans. We try and hire local veterans whenever possible. We try and hire disabled veterans whenever possible. not only for employing veterans, but also we find that many of our vets like talking to other veterans. For those of you that are veterans or know veterans, we kind of develop our own language, our own way of thinking, and own way of doing things. And so we, although our staff is not completely comprised of veterans, we want to make sure that if a veteran walks in and wants to talk to another vet, that they can. And so that's one of the things that we try and pay a lot of attention to in our hiring. In terms of services, we're doing what we call readjustment counseling. And so we're not doing psychiatry. We're not prescribing any kind of medications. But we are providing counseling services. And those services can be individual, group, family counseling. We do have, at our particular vet center, two family therapists. And that's one of the things that distinguishes us from the clinics and VA medical centers is we do work with the families. We have, for example, a significant other's group that we run twice a month in the evenings. So whether it's a spouse or adult child or sister, brother, they have something for them as well. We believe that the integrating family into the readjustment process is something that's necessary for a successful readjustment, and so we do include families as well. We do bereavement counseling also. So for any family member who may have had a service member that died on active duty for any reason, it could be a combat death or a suicide or some other kind of death, we're able to see family members under our bereavement eligibility completely free of charge. We also specialize in military sexual trauma, so we're able to see anybody who is a survivor of military sexual trauma on active duty, and we have specialists. We have three of our counselors now who are military sexual trauma credentialed and qualified to be able to meet with those folks, and that's male and female. Went over a little bit of the eligibility criteria. So again, we're a specialized program, so there are certain veterans we may not be able to see. But again, just to sort of recap, anybody who served in a war zone theater of operations, we're able to see those folks. Anybody who is exposed to military sexual trauma while on active duty, we can see those folks. Family members of anybody that died while on active duty, we can see those people for bereavement counseling. We can also see active duty members who not only served in a direct combat theater of operations, but may have been providing support as well. So any unmanned aerial vehicle pilots, these are the drone pilots who may not physically be in theater, but are certainly exposed to some of the stressors of being in theater, we're able to see those folks. Anybody who worked in mortuary services, processing our killed in action, we're able to see those veterans, and anybody who provided medical care, not just in theater, but for instance, if someone was a doctor or a nurse at Walter Reed Medical Center and was working with our wounded, as you may know, now the technology to be able to help our casualties is fairly sophisticated, to where someone who's wounded in battle may be stateside within a matter of hours versus a matter of days and weeks as it had been in previous wars. As I said, we have over 300 vet centers nationwide. We have, I believe, 32 just in California. California having the largest veteran population of any state in the union. And our county has a very large veteran population as well. Estimates are about 20 to 22,000 veterans just in our county in San Luis Obispo. So there are veterans that seek services through us, through the VA clinic, through the County Veterans Service Office, and through the other organizations that you're going to hear from tonight. Vet centers are very much a community program. It was the vet centers were actually the first community program in the VA system of care. Prior to 1979, if you wanted to get treatment in the VA system, you had to go to a VA medical center. And so the vet centers in 1979, part of the mission was to get outside of the walls of the medical facilities, go out to the communities, and develop community programming. And so our community-based outpatient clinics that you see now and all those 300 vet centers nationwide are really a product of that, to show that it works, that we can't just wait for veterans to come and find us in our major metropolitan areas, that we really do have to go out and make services available in our veterans' own backyards. In certain vet centers have counselors who work directly with active duty. We don't have a huge active duty contingent in our county, but other vet centers do. San Diego, for example, has a counselor at their vet center who's just dedicated to working strictly with active duty members. And so in our county here, we do have a large population of Guard and reservists, and so we do a good number of outreach activities at Camp San Luis Obispo, Camp Roberts, Fort Hunter Liggett. Our service area includes Vandenberg Air Force Base, so we go out there as well. And we do have a lot of units moving through our area. In fact, this is a pretty busy time of year for us and them, where they have large units training up at Camp Roberts and Fort Hunter Liggett. So we try and get out there as much as we can. I'll show you some pictures of that in a minute. But we're not only, again, waiting for veterans. We're not waiting for veterans to come in and find us. We'll go out there and try and find them wherever they are, and that includes veterans that are about to deploy and right after they get back from deployment. And our goal is they hear from us at least twice, and so that they know where to get resources when they need it. One of the things that that we try and do at vet centers is open access of care to beyond just traditional hours. Most VA clinics are open 8 to 4:30, and our vet center is open 8 to 5:30 Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then we're also open one Saturday a month. And so what we try and do, especially for some of our younger veterans who are going to school, who are working during the day, who may have childcare obligations, we want to make sure that our hours are convenient for them, and we're continuing to be flexible with that and trying different things. And I hope to expand our hours even more so we can have more evening, more weekend hours. We can work holidays if we need to be able to provide those services. And so it's one of our goals is to really break down the barriers to accessing care. In terms of the type of care that we provide, as I said, we have professional counselors on staff who are trained in evidence-based therapies for PTSD and for other readjustment-related issues that may be connected to someone's service. And we also do some complementary therapies as well. And so for those of our veterans that are interested in more supportive type therapies or more activity-based types of things, we do that as well. We have close connections with different folks in the community that take our veterans out surfing or fishing or hiking. The county has a program that does that. In fact, I think there's some veterans that are going to go out and do an activity sometime this May. We have an organic gardening group. We have a local farm that actually donated some space for us so we can take our veterans out every Friday morning and teach them organic gardening and getting them together in a different kind of venue. We do a creative arts group. We've really tried to expose our veterans to whatever we can to try and help them with their readjustment, because no readjustment treatment plan looks the same. And so we do the traditional therapies, the individual, the family work, the group work, and then we can also do some of the complementary therapies as well. We also encourage our veterans to try, especially those that are isolative, socially withdrawn, to really kind of step out of their homes. And so we'll do things like, we had a Super Bowl that we hosted at the Vet Center, we've done Army-Navy games, Monday Night Football, barbecues, any of those different kinds of things to really pull our veterans out, have them meet together and collectively heal. Talk to you a bit about bereavement counseling. And we do have specialists, especially trained counselors in that area as well. And sexual trauma counseling also. One of the unique things about the Vet Center program is that I was speaking of our service area. The San Luis Obispo Vet Center is pretty large. It's all of San Luis Obispo County, southern Monterey County, and then northern Santa Barbara County. So it's a fairly large area. And so one of the things that we're able to do, for example, is for our North County veterans, those veterans living basically from the top of the grade north, we have two contract psychologists that work out of a private office in Atascadero So as many of us know, it can be difficult for some people coming down the grade and going back up. It can be kind of like a different world for our North County residents. And so it's another effort that we make at accessibility. So they have a choice. If they'd like to see someone closer to where they live or work in the North County, they can go see one of our contract providers. Both psychologists, both Vietnam veterans, both have done a lot of work in the field of PTSD, and they've been contract providers with the Vet Center program for over 30 years. So we want to make sure that they, our veterans living in the North County, have that availability to them. One of the other things that we do is we have something called a mobile vet center, which is, in most cases, about a 38-foot long RV-looking thing, but if you walk in it, it actually is a mobile vet center. We're able to have two dedicated confidential counseling areas there, and we're able to see people at remote sites, whether it's doing a pre-deployment up at Camp Roberts or somewhere else, maybe in our community. We'll actually have one down at the Santa Maria Elks Rodeo, I think, coming up. And so we try and get out there not only for military-oriented events and happenings, but also at any of the larger-scale activities on the Central Coast here where we think veterans may gather. So we try and capture them, figuratively, that is, and in wherever we can find them. The mobile vet centers, we've also used them to respond to emergencies. And so I think that's important for the commission to know as well. In fact, we deployed several mobile vet centers last year to the wildfires up in Northern California. We deployed a mobile vet center to both of the shootings at Fort Hood to be able to provide on-the-ground counseling services to support our friends over there at Fort Hood. And we also deployed one mobile vet center to the terrorist shootings down in Riverside, again, to be able to be just a community support platform as well as a platform for us to help our local vets. Some more pictures of the mobile vet center on the bottom there. That was up at Fort Hunter Liggett a couple years ago. And so they can have upwards of 7,000 to 8,000 soldiers training up there during the summer. And so we'll go and set our mobile vet centers up at various places where those folks congregate. I think what you see on the TV there, I think it was the NBA playoffs going on at the time. So we'll put things up. We'll do whatever we can to kind of lure people over, whether it's coffee in the middle of the night or setting up flat screen TVs, whatever we can do to have a chance to talk to our soldiers out in the field and try and encourage them to come in for care, or at least inform them about what kind of care is available to them. We also have a 24/7, what we call a combat call center. The larger VA runs a 24/7 crisis hotline. And so this is another version of that, where 24/7 a veteran can call up, talk to another combat veteran if they need to. They don't necessarily need to be in crisis, but if it's in the middle of the night, I can't sleep, I'm having some dreams, or I'm just restless, and our vet center is not open 24/7, but they can call these men and women at the combat call center and have someone to talk to. Our counselors will then get a confidential email first thing in the morning letting us know that someone called from our area, or maybe one of our clients called, and we can follow up in that way. So we want to make sure that we cover as many bases as we can, and so that 24/7 combat call center is just one other resource that we can give our local vets to reach out to us when they're in need. Our goal is to do things like reduce the suicide rate and reduce the incarceration rate among veterans. We see a lot of veterans from the Veterans Treatment Court in this county, and some of them come in because they're forced to. We'd like to see a whole lot more that come in before they get to that point, and so this is just one of those other things that we try and do just to make it as easy as possible for people to seek help. We have working groups, so we try and be conscious of diversity among the veteran community, and so some of our staff have been part of these working groups, and we try and reach out to segments of the veteran population that tend to be underserved. So, for example, this will be the fifth year in a row that we've gone to the Chumash Intertribal Powwow, and so we are and have been the only U.S. federal government entity invited to the powwow every year, and there are a number of Native Americans that are also veterans, and so we get to meet a lot of people not only from our local area but from outside of the area as well. And so it's an example of some of the things that we do to really try and reach out to the full complement of our veteran population. I think that's just about it for me. Welcome to any questions, and invite you all to come over and check out the Vet Center. I've given you some brochures, so feel free to come on by or call, and we'd love to see you over there.
Thank you very much. That was very interesting. Are there any questions from commissioners? Commissioner Klaus?
Yeah, Mike, thank you very much for telling that story. That was very inspiring and I'm sure very important. I'm interested in how many vets you get to for your services that you described to us. What is the average number of vets, and has that increased over the years?
I think so, yeah. We, at any one time, we have about 200 active veterans on our caseloads, and by active, meaning that they're engaging. If someone's not actively engaging, then we're talking to them and trying to get them to do that. So our numbers are pretty accurate in that respect. I think we're not able to capture every single veteran that we see every time, because some choose not to enroll, or some we were able to provide services to them without their enrollment. But I can say that I was looking at some numbers last week that we've reached about 1,500 veterans that have actually gone through our program that have actively engaged. And so it sort of ebbs and flows in terms of people coming in. Sometimes when the economy wasn't doing so well and people maybe were having trouble finding health care, or when they were looking maybe to apply for a disability through the VA, we were seeing a little bit of an uptick then. We do nearly 200 outreach events a year, so we really do try and canvas the area. But I think there's definitely things that we can do better. I think we do need to reach out to the private healthcare faction in our county a little bit better. We do a lot with the public, with the county, and public service agencies, but I think we do need to reach out to private providers to let us know, or let them know rather, what we do and how we do it. In terms of the population, we serve, I think our youngest veteran right now is about 23 years old, and our oldest is 95. So we have veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we still have veterans coming in from Korea and World War II. In fact, we have a World War II Korea group just for those folks that we run once a month. And then we still have a good number of Vietnam veterans that are coming in for the first time. And those ladies and gentlemen are in their 60s and 70s, and some are newly retired, or they're coming in for various reasons. But we, like I said before, we'd really like to get them in before anything gets critical. And so we do need, and I'm always open to hearing more about what we can do in terms of outreach and getting the word out.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Commissioner Kingston-Barr.
Along with getting the word out, what do you do in order to integrate with some of the other nonprofits and some of the other organizations to get them to refer to you?
It's a good question. We, in fact, I'm going later this week to the SLO County Suicide Prevention Committee. So I try and go to as many committee meetings as I can of anything that may be even remotely related to what we do. And some of our other staffers go as well. Again, there, you know, one of the interesting things about this county is I'm always learning about new resources out there, and there are really a lot. And as much as we do to try and reach out and let people know about who we are and what we do, there seems to be people that we keep missing. So if there are any committees or are there any other venues that you can think about that we might be able to go to, we're more than willing to do that. We're always looking for something, and whether it's going to a meeting like this or inviting people to come in, we've had an open house the last couple of years. We just did a 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War commemoration event, which wasn't open to the public. It was really just for our vets, but we're always looking to do more of those kind of things.
Do you know if the organizations ask when they have an admission of a patient or they have a client coming in for services, do they ask if that's a veteran?
I think some places do. I think that was a big discussion item when we were talking about the Veterans Treatment Court in our county here.
Right.
I had a chance to be on that initial committee, and it was, how do we identify veterans? It's great if we have the resources, but oftentimes, you know, we miss that identification process. So there is something fairly new where a veteran can actually, on their California driver's license, designate that they're a veteran. So I think that helps in certain ways. And I've seen certain intake documents that ask people if they're a veteran, which I think mm-hmm. is a really just great thing to do, especially in healthcare, because mm-hmm. there are healthcare issues specific to veterans. Our Vietnam veterans with their Agent Orange exposure, and our Desert Storm veterans with Gulf War syndrome, and all of our veterans really have been exposed to environmental contaminants and other types of things mm-hmm. that healthcare providers sometimes don't screen for if they don't know that person's a veteran.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of Can an individual, I wasn't clear, can a dependent be receiving services from you when the vet is not?
No, the veteran would have to be receiving services.
Okay.
So the veteran would be the principal client, and then
once they're in treatment, then their dependents can receive services.
Correct.
Okay.
And I should say the services do have to be related to that veteran's war zone experience.
Okay.
So for instance, if that veteran has a child and that child's having difficulty in school, maybe because of ADHD, that wouldn't necessarily be something that we would see. We would work with that family to get a referral. But if that same child were having trouble in school because mom just has been on 3 deployments in the last 6 years, then that's absolutely something that we would get involved in.
Okay. And then do you have a sense of how many dependents you have on your caseload?
Oh, that's a good question. No.
Sorry, I'm full of questions.
Yeah, no, they're great questions. I would have to think about that one, because we don't really track that in the same way that we track our veterans, because the veteran is the identified client. And so some of our veterans, their significant others, their families aren't involved at all in their
right.
care. Some more indirectly, and some very directly, like they're engaging in couples counseling or they're in our significant others group or something along those lines. But we don't identify them as clients.
Okay.
We identify our veterans as the client.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any more questions from Commissioner Warren?
Hi, thank you very much
for
your presentation. A couple questions. The first one I have right now is, we did a trauma-informed training here last month, and we're going to be seeing more of that over the next few years. My question to you is, do you have some kind of an educational program on veterans and PTSD that can be given to clinicians and doctors groups and nurses, so they understand who they're dealing with in their hospital or their office? That's a big complaint. I work in a recovery resource center, and that's a complaint I hear a lot about the healthcare system.
Yes, we do that, and we do get requests. And what we try and do is take our materials and then tailor it for that particular organization and what their needs are. So we've done some guest lectures over at Cal Poly. We've done some faculty and staff development down at Hancock College, letting them know about veterans in the classroom. And we've met with different healthcare organizations, probably not as many as we'd like or as we would need to. And we've given that same sort of training. Now, it's not a training where one can get CMEs or CEUs or those different kinds of things. It's more of kind of an in-service type of thing. But I think it's valuable, especially for folks who haven't been exposed to veteran culture and to some of the health and mental health illnesses and disorders that are not necessarily specific to veterans, but we see a higher level of prevalence among veterans.
Yeah, I find it really hard to refer them to health care because of the, they just get re-traumatized through the, by the providers.
Right, in some cases, yeah. And I should say that one of the things that we really try and do is we spend a good amount of time with our veterans. And I should say this too, there's no cost. If they meet that eligibility criteria, there's no cost at all. On the larger VA, there may be a copayment associated with a visit, depending on if that person is service-connected disabled or how much income they make. So our services are no cost, lifetime, and they can come in really for as long as they need to. It's not, okay, 12 sessions and that's it. So we can take our time, and that's part of that trauma-informed care approach is really building that rapport and that relationship, that therapeutic alliance with the veteran is really key, and it's just a major factor in positive outcomes in any kind of treatment that you give someone.
Do you have any particular focus on our homeless population? And it seems that we have a number of Vietnam vets in particular. What kind of programs are you guys putting together for that?
So we work, you're gonna hear from Bob in a few minutes here from SSVF, and so the VA and several different organizations locally here in the nonprofit sector have been working with our homeless veteran population, and it's certainly something that we work with as well. VA has a program called VASH, VA Supported Housing, and we host two VASH workers that actually work out of our vet center twice a week. And so if we have any homeless veterans that come in, we're able to refer to a number of different programs, and vice versa. We do a lot of cross-pollination with our community partners. So if someone comes in contact with a homeless veteran that may be eligible for vet center services, we're very often working together on that care plan to make sure that we're meeting those, helping with the counseling part of it. Our counselors also do a good amount of case management. So it's not just a 50-minute therapy session. If there are other needs that need to be met, we're working on those oftentimes first. It's very mm-hmm. hard to do trauma-focused right. therapy with someone if they're homeless or if they're in need of, they haven't seen a primary care provider in 10 years. If their, you know, diabetes is poorly regulated, we're not going to start getting into trauma therapy until we get some of those needs met. So we work very closely with a number of different agencies to include the VA clinics to try and get people those needs met first and foremost.
Okay. And my last question is, because I our program's located up in North County, I have a question about the you said there's two psychologists up there, and what would be the process to refer someone to them?
We really, one of the traditions of the Vet Center program, in fact, and you can probably imagine this in your head, it was founded by Vietnam veterans trying to help other Vietnam veterans. And so in response to sort of the bureaucracy of the VA at that time, their first motto of the Vet Center program was help without hassles. And so we try and continue that philosophy, and so we keep it easy. You can just give me a call. I'll take basic information over the phone, and we'll call that person. When a veteran comes into our vet center, they never fill out a piece of paperwork. We do all the paperwork for them. We really try and make it, I don't want to say a pleasurable experience, but we try and make it an experience that that people are going to want to come back to. And with all the outreach that we do, still our best referral source is word of mouth. Other veterans telling other veterans, hey, you can go here. You can trust these folks. They're going to help you out. They always got hot coffee ready to go, and if you just want to come in and hang out, that's okay too. So you could just give us a call, and we'll make sure that we get them to where they need to be.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was very informative, and as we're all aware, there's a lot of services out there that we, as a group of citizens, are not aware of, and this is hopefully going to help more people be aware.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Grantham.
Thank you, Mike. That was fantastic. Really great. So our next speaker is Gil Eigelhart from Paws for a Cause to talk about dogs.
Thank you all for having me up here. Great opportunity to let you know what we're trying to do. Dick, why don't you come up to the other podium so that we can do our normal dog and pony show. This is quite interesting because 30 some odd years ago, I worked for him in the insurance business, and here we are, we meet 30 years later in Cayucas, of all places. 2.5 years ago, I went to a Rotary training seminar for potential Rotary leaders in Southern California. There was a gentleman that spoke. He was a two-time Iraq-Afghanistan veteran who had come home, actually wanted to go back for the third time. But the military doctors saw that he had been wounded quite severely with shrapnel, and he was telling them that he was fine and ready to go. So they said, no, you can't. You're going to have to basically retire. You can't go back. So for the next year and a half, he lived in his parents' basement with his wife and two children and mom and dad upstairs. Couldn't go up the stairs until they went to bed at night because he was suffering from post-traumatic stress so bad. When I heard that, I went, something has to be done. So when I came back, Dick was already talking to Corey over at Woods Humane Society. And I was dealing with a company that Jason Haig, who was the gentleman, the captain from the Marine Corps, in the basement. I formed a bond with him, and he was working for a company in Florida called Canines for Warriors, and we tried to do work for them in California. But in order to raise that kind of funds, people don't want to give money to an organization in Florida because there's no hands-on. They don't know where the money goes. So I started asking questions, and I was told that that information is not attainable by myself. So Dick and I thought, well, you know what? That's too bad. We're going to start our own. So being headstrong that I am, I went and started talking to a lady in Cayucas who used to do blind dogs, Michelle Lilly. She told me that she was working for an organization in San Luis Obispo on Buckley Road called New Life Canines. So we invited Woods and New Life Canines to lunch and asked them if they would like to partner together to bring the dogs to New Life so that New Life could train them to give them to veterans with post-traumatic stress. 1 week later, we had our first dog. Now we have an organization. We are a 501c3 as of about a month ago. And I'm going to give you a little bit of the background on what we're trying to do. We are 100% volunteers. We're using Rotary clubs throughout San Luis Obispo County. We're using their leg power, manpower, and their volunteerism to get the word out. We consider ourselves to be a mechanism for sustainability. All the money that we raise goes right to New Life Canines for the dogs and the trainers. The money for brochures that I've given all of you people tonight, we pay for these out of our pocket. We sell t-shirts, we sell pins, we sell badges, we sell whatever we have to sell to make this 100% for the veteran. Very important for us because of some of the things that have happened in other organizations. Probably not aware of right now, but 22 veterans a day commit suicide due to post-traumatic stress. And that's without 5 states reporting this. And I'm hoping that I'll be able to get with Mike to find out. California, Texas, Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida do not report veterans' deaths from suicide because of post-traumatic stress. So 22 a day is a far cry from what is actually taking place. That's 8,000 veterans a year that are killing themselves. That's a far, far greater number than have been lost in the entire Middle East conflict. And that is a shame. That's got to stop. Our objective is to raise the awareness with all of you in this room tonight and the people that might be watching on the news and the media that we are here. We're going to do as best we can to make sure that this doesn't happen. The cost of raising and training a dog right now is about $15,000. We have now enlisted the aid of veteran inmates and inmates at CMC Prison. We have 15 prisoners that are training 8 dogs 24 hours a day, 5 days a week. The other 2 days, they go home with a guard or a staff member to socialize in the general public, restaurants, movie theaters, dances, whatever.
Gail, I think something that's important there is the research that has been done is from a lady, Sister Catherine in New Jersey. And their puppy raising program is what we've duplicated. Their success rate on dogs that graduate, that go through this as a puppy, is in the high 90 percentile. The best that we can do, and we're probably closer to 40% than we are 50%. So the 24/7 contact human canine relationship is very helpful in that.
Thank you. That's why we do so good. I forget stuff, he reminds me. The partnering that we've done with Woods is, not everybody needs a service dog. Some people have a companion dog. So what we've done is we've taken place with Woods, where we've donated, I think, over 50?
I think it's closer to 60.
60 dogs we've given to veterans through Woods that help them with their everyday life. But the service dog part of this, we just gave one to a Losos Rotarian by the name of Bruce Hewlin. Bruce lost a leg because of Agent Orange from the Vietnam War. A year and a half ago, he lost his leg. His wife, Shirley, said he went right back into the Vietnam syndrome again, the post-traumatic stress, the sleeplessness, the heavy sweats at night, the tossing and turning. I went out today and took pictures of this man with a smile all the way across his face because of this dog. His wife said he wouldn't even get out of the house. He was stuck in the house because he lost his leg. And this dog has taken him out to the park. And he sits there for 3 hours a day throwing the tennis ball. The dog's getting all the exercise, and he's got the grin on his face. It's phenomenal. It's a win-win. Can't lose. And now with the veterans training the dogs, it's going to bring the price down from $15,000 down to $7,000 or $8,000. So our job has just gotten half easier now because the price is down. So we really want to get the word out. We really want to help these guys and ladies that need our help. And all it takes is for people to be a little bit more aware of what's going on and to help. You know, we do all kinds of different service things, fundraisers. We're going to start to do a few more. There's a couple other things that we have going right now in the pipeline that we can't talk about yet. But it's even bigger than getting the prisoners involved in the training. So, thank you. Any more, Dick?
Well, I just think as a note of thank you, we really don't know what we don't know. And I mean that very honestly. There are so many different opportunities of service. We know nothing about the military. Neither one of us are veterans, had no experience whatsoever. So the learning curve has been incredible. But the language of a veteran to veteran, if we can somehow continue to get the word out through them, there's a study going on right now at Purdue University that is measuring the impact. The federal government said, this is a joke. Go buy a dog, get over, you know, the syndrome problems. Well, the impact is significant. So if two guys in a truck, which we really are, both have trucks, can make an impact on lives, we'd love to see the federal government someday do a little bit more about that to help. Evenings like this really help get the word out. Any questions? Anybody want to?
Questions from commissioners? Commissioner Kingston-Barker.
How do you, at this point, interface with the vet center, or do you right now with the individuals that are identified or in counseling there?
I think this will be the start of that. Thanks to you guys.
Right.
You know, this is the first time I've ever been introduced to Mike, so I look forward to a working relationship with them.
The referrals don't come from us. We're working with other military sponsors that we talked about yet today. That's where the veterans will come from, and they really shouldn't come from us or to us. They won't anyway because we don't speak veteran. But it should go to people that know what they're doing with that lead. And that has increased.
We partnered with MOAA, which is Military Officers of America, Association of America, MOWW, Military Officers of World Wars, and the Marine Corps Detachment 680 League. So they're helping us find the veterans that we will turn over to Jack at New Life. And they have a process there where there's an application. Not the first dog and the first veteran. That's not a positive match. So they take into consideration the age of the veteran, the age of the dog, to make sure that a 75-year-old gentleman or lady doesn't get a dog that's a year and a half or 2 years old, because the dog is going to be wanting to run and do all kinds of different stuff, and the other person may want to sit inside all day long. So that match has to be a perfect match for those two to get along together.
Our goal is to still, and our dedication is, we are local. We are Slo County. We don't want any dogs outside this Slo County. But over time, it looks like this is going to be growing at a reasonably rapid rate for other people in other cities to do exactly what we're doing. We don't want to get on an airplane. We don't want to become, you know, famous for any of this, except that we started with no prisons, and we now have, I think, in the state of California, four prisons that want to work with us and the organizations that we brought together, because the skill level is so different in each one of these groups. That's amazing, because there were always two problems, one on each side of the formula. Where do we get the dogs for the number of veterans we have, and who's going to train them? This organization is quickly becoming Train the Trainer. And with that kind of firepower in San Luis Obispo County, we got to go raise some money.
Have you gotten feedback about a secondary benefit for the inmates that are training the dogs?
You want to answer that? You talked to Jack today. Well, one of the things I'd like to clarify real quick, when we say we've gotten into trouble with this once or twice before. When we say we don't just mean Paws for a Cause, Dick and myself. We mean New Life Canines and Paws for a Cause, mm-hmm. because we work in unison with New Life Canines. They are the dog trainers and the trainers of the trainers. All we do is raise money to give to them.
Thank you.
And to answer the question about the
secondary benefits to the inmates.
Secondary benefits.
Well, that's another learning curve for both of us. We don't get a lot of information from the prisons, even though they're very supportive. Once again, that's a language we don't get much information on. But one of the comments that really struck both of us was one of the non-trainer people said, you know what, I haven't touched an animal in 20-some years.
Yeah.
And that he was able to interface with these dogs. The dogs here are in a dormitorium. They're not locked up in a cell at night. So all of the dog training program is in-housed in one room, as we know it. We've not been inside prison yet, at least for this.
Be careful.
Yeah, I shouldn't have gone there, right? No, we've not been invited inside, but we have a program where we're going to do a fair amount of video work in there. But it that's slow to come, very slow to come.
Pat Nolan has said, who has that CMC, has said it's made a major difference with the inmates that are there seeing the trainers come in with the dogs. So it's softening up, as much as that could be reasonable to think, softening up the inmates somewhat.
Sister Catherine has a word for that. There are two words, actually. Restorative justice, and her comment is, and she's about this tall, her comment is, okay, you did something really bad. Admit it. And is that the last chapter of the story? Or are you going to get yourself back in a position of playing it forward? So restorative justice is, hey, come help us. Come do something that's positive that you can do.
Yeah.
And they are.
Any other questions from commissioners? Commissioner Warren.
Thanks. Thank you so much for your presentation. And I will mention, I think it's Arapaho County. There's a sheriff that developed a program to help with the prisoners. I think it's Arizona or New Mexico. And it's one that's been out there for a few years, and they've been looking at that because it does help them just as much as it helps the veterans. My couple of questions, I know that we're, as a country, we're beginning to look more at using service dogs. What about is there any of them that might be trained to help people with special medical needs with some of our veterans?
Well, one of the things that they have, they call it early graduation. 50% of our dogs in the public, and that's not just our organization, 50% of them wash out because they come through the Humane Society's rescue dogs, and that means they bring some fleas. All of those dogs are placed someplace, some of which are more service-oriented than others. They become bomb dogs, they become airplane dogs, they become police dogs. not for the aggression piece of it. They become therapy dogs where they go into nursing homes and hospitals and things like that. So they're put back in the community very well trained. But one of the reasons they fail is their aggression towards other dogs and standing up for their new owner. That'll throw them out. You can't do that.
That's what happened to the dog that I took the pictures of this morning.
Okay, and a little more specific to that I know that because some dogs they're finding have, let's say if somebody's blood sugar levels are dropping, very specific to medical, physical problems. And I don't know, I'm sure you guys probably haven't looked at that yet, but I just wondered if that's something that the dogs maybe get screened for, because some of them may be have that ability, that particular special ability to work with a very medically fragile person.
One of the things that these dogs do, Commissioner Warren, is that if the veteran wakes up in the middle of the night, the dog can sense whether the veteran's taking his meds that night. Mm-hmm. The dog can go over to the medicine cabinet, grab the meds, take it to the veteran. First off, it can go turn the light on.
Wow.
Then it can go get the meds, bring it to the veteran. Then it'll go back to the refrigerator that has a rope attached to it, open the refrigerator, and grab the water.
Wow.
One gentleman was driving down the freeway, and his dog had his head on his lap, and a guy cut him off. And the dog sensed that he was about ready to go into road rage and got up and licked him in the face.
Wow. Thank you.
We don't know how this happens. One of the best, if not the best, chronology, what's that?
Sonology.
Sonology is in Santa Rosa, California. It's called Bergen University, that you can attain a master's degree in sonology, which is the
study of canines.
Yeah. And I know right now they have two dogs in training as a specialty. We have, both of our trainers are graduates of that school. One is for autism. I really don't know how that works, but it's very effective. And the other one is diabetes. I know they have two dogs in training right now from that, totally independent of what we're doing.
Wow, good. You'll be hearing from me.
By the way, I've heard a lot about where are the dogs tonight. We can bring them back anytime.
Yeah, anytime you'd like to see the dog and pony show, we can actually bring the dogs in here and you can see what they do. I'll tell you, once you see it, you won't believe it.
I have one other question, which is a huge frustration, and I'm hoping there's rules that they can get around this, but even our homeless veterans and our people that rent, you know, all the rules against anybody having a dog in their home if they don't own their own home. And have we got some kind of a piece to get around that?
I was on the CAR Council for 10 years, which is the California Association of Realtors. I was past president of Sandy Coast Board of Realtors. That's something I'm going to address because these dogs are so much better behaved than some people that I've seen in houses that they should be allowed to buy the house and let some people live in it. It's not really the dog's fault that a lot of these dogs tear houses up. Dogs are, all they want to be done is loved. Pet them, fed, and loved. And if you do that, you got a successful dog. I better be careful saying that. I have an 11-month-old puppy at home right now by himself. So hopefully when I get home, I'll still have a home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was very interesting and entertaining.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Grantham.
Thank you, Gil and Dick Mellinger, who didn't get introduced. That was very good. Our next speaker is Bob Ellis from Supportive Services for Veterans Families. Thank you, Bob.
Good evening, commissioners, and thank you very much for the invitation to come and speak. A couple tough acts to follow right there, but I'll do my best. First thing I'd like to say is that it's really encouraging to see that the uptick in veteran services that are being provided now. I'm a Vietnam-era veteran, and getting out back in the 70s, didn't see much of this, so it's very, very, uh, Very good. I'm going to speak to you. I work for the Community Action Partnership here in SLO, and I'm going to talk to you about the Supportive Services for Veteran Families. It is a program that we, a grant that we were awarded back in 2014. The program nationwide has actually been in existence since 2012. It is a result of the government's emphasis on giving back to our veterans and realizing that we really have a big problem with unhoused veterans in our country. So we tried in 2012 and 2013 to bring the money here, but as you know, with many of these major grants, they start at the big metropolitan areas and then they trickle down to the more rural areas like ourselves. So we didn't give up. We kept at it, and we got a grant in 2014 of $4.9 million to address the unhoused population of veterans in our county. Our mission, our program mission is that we're and staff in collaboration with community partners. It's committed to providing the necessary services to eligible veterans and their families that will enable them to become or remain stably housed. As I said, the Veteran Homelessness Initiative began back in 2010 in the White House, and the VA issued a plan to end veteran homelessness by the end of 2015. We are now in 2016. We're still working on it, but that was a floating date. But then we'll get there. The initiative has been very successful so far. In our 2014 PIT, point in time count, that's the enumeration report that we do every 2 years, our homeless veteran population went down by 33% since 2010. That's a good sign. So our services, we offer two different types of services for our veterans here. We have it says homelessness prevention. I like to call it loss of housing prevention, where we can come in and assist a veteran and their family to remain housed if they're at imminent risk of losing their home. And there's a couple of different factors that can play into that. If they get a 14-day or quit notice or a 3-day or quit notice, we can come in there and hopefully negotiate with the landlord to get them to stay. We can offer to pay rental arrears to keep them in the unit. We have a very good, actually two now very good housing placement specialists who work with the landlords in the area. We also subcontract with San Luis Obispo Legal Alternatives Foundation, which they can provide some counseling and some mediation with landlords and tenant relationships to help them retain their housing. We also offer rapid rehousing. That's for our unhoused veterans and veteran households. And this is if they are on the streets, in the creek, in the emergency shelter, otherwise unhoused in the county. We can offer case management service and a number of different other services, both indirect and direct, as well as some temporary financial assistance to get them housed as rapidly as possible. We are a housing first model where our job is to get them in a unit and house as soon as possible, and then do the wraparound services to address the needs or the barriers or the issues that maybe have caused them to end up on the streets or in the creeks. And we use a but-for criteria, but for our services, they would remain unhoused or they would become unhoused. Services that we offer, our big services, as Mike mentioned, outreach is huge for us, and a forum like this helps us with that outreach service. We attend many, many events in the county, and we squeak outside the county sometimes too. We are very collaborative with our service providers, as Mike mentioned. We work very closely with our HUD-VASH folks, and helping too, because they have certain restrictions, we have certain restrictions, but when we sit down and we talk, we can help, we can support each other in helping the veterans that we are responsible for. Case management is the next large piece of it, and the case, we have some fabulous case managers on board. One was just awarded a hero from the Red Cross the other night, Sandra. She is actually a subcontracted case manager at the VSO through the county. As I said, we offer legal assistance through our subcontract with SLOLAF to assist and resolve issues. We subcontract with America's Job Center. We have an employment development specialist that works in the AJC for job readiness assistance, resume writing, employment counseling, employment recruitment, employer recruitment, I should say, job search, just all sorts of ways that they can get them back. And what's interesting is that this gentleman who works at the AJC, he's a vet. 90% of the people who work on our program are vets. He understands, but he also understands that sometimes veterans come out of the service not knowing the skills that they really have, and also not knowing how to transfer those skills to civilian life. So he's very adept at looking at those particular items. I think the slide went off the top there. There it is. Additional services, housing barrier assessment, emergency housing stability assistance. If we have a veteran who's on a street who is medically fragile, and we know that him or her remaining on the street could put that person at extreme risk, and we can fairly be assured that we'll have a unit for that person, and within 45 days we can put them in a motel with emergency housing money. The temporary financial assistance I talked about, it's rental assistance, it's security deposit, it's housing stability assistance, it's an application fee, car repair, tokens for mass transportation, just a number of different things we can use a temporary financial assistance for. Housing counseling, rental agreement education, VA benefits assistance. This is really, really crucial for a lot of our veterans who don't understand or don't know, or for whatever reason refuse to look for or obtain these benefits. But we've been very successful in the veterans we have in our program now. They are receiving VA benefits that they are entitled to. Landlord-tenant mediation and future housing stability plan. Eligibility requirements, they must be unhoused or at imminent risk of becoming unhoused. They have to be a veteran or a member of a family in which a veteran is the household or a spouse or significant other. So we assist the whole family. If a veteran household, say the veteran maybe has a job, but to keep them housed or to get them in a house, if a significant other or a spouse may need some job training, we can provide that to the family members. Child care, we can provide child care or child care referral processes. They must have a discharge other than dishonorable, and they must have an income that's considered very low income, which cannot exceed 50% of the area median income. And there's a little chart right there, which is probably hard to read, but you can see 30% for one person of the area median income in here is slow as $16,000, and at 50% it's 26. And I think the area median income right now is about $76,000 for SLO County. Collaboration is huge for our program, collaborating with the other service providers in the area. The big one is referrals. Of course, getting referrals from the other service providers. We get it from the shelters. We get it from service organizations. We get it from the American Legion Hall. We get it from the street. We get it from the healthcare facilities. So there's a number of ways they can self-refer also. We are always looking at resources that can assist our program, and we are always looking at donations, because there's many things that we can't, regulations prevent us from, providing. I know that the Elks and the American Legion have been unbelievable. In fact, we have to rent a storage unit because our offices are getting so full, people can't work in them. So that's a good thing. So we're going to, Meathead Movers is going to rent us a storage unit so we can put these things in store. And these can be dishes and towels and bed sheets and all these things that we can't really provide. We can provide them a bed when they move in. We can buy them a bed and get them in there. We can provide emergency cleaning supplies and things like that for the shower and other. But as far as towels and sheets and other household items, we're restricted from purchasing those. So we looked for donations on that part. Current, as of the 6th of May, these are our current statistics so far. And let me just back up a minute. We got the grant in October of 2014, but we really didn't get up and running fully staffed until the end of January 2015. So we've been in this little over a year and 4 months, 5 months, since we've really been on the ground. And since that time, we've engaged over 240 veterans. We have determined that 100 of that 240, 149 have been determined eligible and services have been provided. 65 veteran households we have placed into housing, taken off the streets, out of the creeks, out of the shelters, and provided housing for them. A total of 97, so 65 households was a total of 97 people, including family members, children, and significant others or spouses. 47 veteran households, we've prevented them from losing their housing. The number 18 unemployed is a little low. Right now we're about 22 that they've obtained a job through our job placement referral services and through the AJC. We've had 49 referred to other providers, SSVF, HUD-VASH, and there's another SSVF program in the county, but they mainly focus on the south part of the county. We focus on SLO and North County and the coast. Family members that have been served of 30 children and 26 spouses, or I should say significant others on those. And our temporary financial assistance up until this point or until May 6th for homeless prevention, about $128,000. And for rapid rehousing, about $228,000. So we like to look at the TFA, we call it, the temporary financial assistance, as a last resort. We always look to the community and other service providers or other resources in the community to address the need first, and then if the temporary financial assistance is a but-for piece of the program. We have currently three locations. We just opened up our new office in Los Osos on Van Buren Drive. We have a case manager there and a housing placement specialist, and soon to put a veteran advocate. I should explain what those job descriptions are. Our veteran advocate, I like to call my search and rescue team. These are the ones that go out, hit the streets, hit the events, hit the creeks, hit the bars in a good way, hit the grocery stores, hit the liquor stores, wherever we are, the recycle places, wherever we can think, and we're constantly thinking about where can we go next to see if we can find those in need. That's my search and rescue team, the veteran advocates. Case managers, pretty self-explanatory. They are the ones who are responsible for case managing, building the housing stability plan for our veterans. And our housing placement specialists, those are the ones who go out and seek out the housing. And as we all know, the housing, here's lots of housing here in SLO. We don't have a problem with that. A little tongue-in-cheek there. They have been doing a phenomenal job of finding housing. And almost all communities in the county have been stepping up. Los Osos, 10 vets housed there. Atascadero, I think 8 there. Paso Robles, 12 there. Shell Beach, Pismo Beach, San Miguel. I mean, they've been just covering the county. Lots of miles being put on. We have a North County office on Riverside Drive where we have a case manager, an administrative assistant, and a veteran advocate there. And then my office is, the San Luis Obispo office is inside the VSO office. on Grand Avenue. And that's all I have for our program. Are there any questions?
Questions from commissioners? Commissioner Warren.
I just want to thank you very much, Bob, for all the great work you guys are doing and for everybody tonight. I just have a quick question. Can we get a copy of the PowerPoint tonight from both Mike and you? You could send them to Jean, and then she'll send them out to us.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great.
You have them right there. But the slide that has the update,
mm-hmm.
that will be old news probably next week. So.
Oh, okay. But it's some news.
Yes,
so.
Okay.
Commissioner Kington Parker.
Yeah.
How do veterans access the service? Do they just call to one of the offices?
They can call the office.
Okay.
They can walk into the VSO.
Okay.
If they walk into the vet center,
Mike
can refer over. Mm-hmm. Number of different avenues that they can refer. HUD-VASH, like I said, we have a very good relationship with HUD-VASH. What they do is when they get a new veteran come into their system, they automatically refer them to us if they're homeless and see if we can help out initially. Because once HUD-VASH takes them on and they get a voucher and they get housed, we can provide some light touch services, but we can't really case manage them or provide them any financial assistance.
Okay.
But up until that point, we can work together very closely to get that veteran household.
And can dependents be the first point of contact, or it needs to be the veteran?
Dependents can be the first point of contact. I've had sons, daughters, mothers, wives, significant others call us and say, hey, this is the situation.
If somebody wanted to donate in-kind services, like you were saying they needed, how would they do that?
Just call the office.
One
of those offices. And on the brochure, I don't know, did you get the brochure?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I do have one.
Yeah, the phone number on the brochure is my phone number.
Okay.
So you can call me directly, and I have a truck. I can come up and pick up anything that you have.
Okay. And then a final question, is there any kind of incentive for any homeowners, property owners that would be outside of the goodwill of providing services to a veteran? Is there a tax write-off? Is there anything?
No.
Okay.
There isn't a tax write-off, but there is a terrific team that comes with the veteran.
And what kind of services do they provide to the homeowner that's a benefit for them? To the veteran. So you're saying there's a team.
That's the team. What I mean is it's the SSCF team, the veteran who's going to become the tenant, and the landlord.
And so you're really kind of supervising the veteran as well?
Oh, yes.
To make sure that they're
Once the veteran is placed, we still have case management, follow-up, routine visits. Depending on the, they prioritize how much they need to visit, depending on the issues that are there. Absolutely there. If sometimes it's twice a week, where another veteran might be once a month, but there's always contact. The landlord has numerous different numbers that they can call if there's an issue, and we're on it all the time.
Okay, that's huge.
Yeah.
That's huge. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other? Commissioner Campbell.
Yes, I think you mentioned that you've seen a 30% decrease in the number of homeless vets. Over what period was that?
I have to look back at this. I think it was 2010 to 2014. That's what it was. I know in our last count, the PIT, which was in 2015, there was 130 veterans counted in the county. Now, of course, that's just a snapshot. We don't catch everybody. The last one before that, there was about 350 that were counted. Now, whether we missed some in the latest one, we don't know. But there was a significant reduction for some reason.
And if I heard right, your particular services just began in late 2014?
Late 2014.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to what can we attribute this remarkable decline in homelessness in vets, because I would bet it's more than reversed in the general population.
Well, I would like I say, I wouldn't put too much stock in the numbers themselves, because they are a snapshot, a point in time count. I know that when we first started counting, and I attended some of the meetings about the point in time count, I was concerned about the way the questions that were being asked, because I know from my own personal experience being a veteran from the Vietnam era, if somebody asked me way back, you know, are you a veteran, I would say no. So we've changed that, and sometimes those on the street might think of a veteran as being somebody who's been in for 20 years and is getting retirement. So we change it to say, have you served in the military, or were you in the Army, or were you in the Marines, or whatever. You sound like you were in the Marines. Were you in the Marines, or were you in the military or something? So it increased the number that we were saying yes. But to speak to your the apparent decline, I believe there was a decline in unhoused veterans in our county. I don't think it was that much. But I know our HUD-VASH program, and just recently our program has, in the last year and a half, has made a significant impact on bringing veterans off the street and into housing. I hope that answers your question somewhat.
Any other
it's
questions?
It's a hard question.
Yeah. You always ask the hard questions. Commissioner Warren?
Yes, in response to that, which brings up another issue, is that there's a RVs for Veterans program. And so people were very generous in donating these RVs. But now we've come up in a problem, because there's no parks that will accept them. And even though we've been able to house them, there's where can they park?
Right.
So I was really glad to hear that maybe we can get the business community and the realtor community and everybody kind of coming together to see what kind of solutions are out there. And I just wanted to give a shout out that I saw in the Telegram Tribune's recent little magazine they published on the BizBuzz, which goes out to all the business people. There was an ad in there that Scott Smith from Haslow put in there about housing a veteran and asking people, do you have an extra room? Would you be willing to house a veteran? And I just thought, great, we're finally, this is a countywide problem, and it involves, we're all going to have to work together. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it saves money at every level if we can house people and help them get well.
Yeah.
And so I'm glad to see that all the factions are starting to at least be asked to come to the table.
Yeah, speaking of Haslow, they have a wall raising on May 31st. For housing units just for veterans, homeless veterans, and very low-income veterans. That's going up on Humbert Avenue, right across from the new development they just put up there off of Broad. So May 31st, it's on Humbert Avenue, off of Victoria, I think, which is off of Broad. I think it's about 20 units, but don't quote me on that. But that's great.
Well, thank you all very much. There were a lot of good questions and a lot of good information, and thank you, Commissioner Grantham, for putting this together for us tonight. And it's been extremely worthwhile for all involved, I think, to have you all here and talk to us about an issue that oftentimes we go, well, is the health of our veterans a question? Is it? And yes, indeed. Thank you. Thank you for being here. All right, then. We will move on to the next area of our agenda, our exciting health agency report. Dr. Borenstein?
You're going to set me up, huh? excuse me. I do have a few
things I want to tell you about. We are in the middle of National Nurses Week, so happy National Nurses Week. Happy National Nurses Week. I think I've gotten, Well, there was a Doctor's Day, it turns out. I learned about it after the fact. But so May 6th through May 12th, and we did have a little get-together, and thank you for many of our nurses. They number about 45 in our public health department, plus we have about a dozen in the correctional environment, in the jail and juvenile services, and there are more in the behavioral health department, but I don't know their number. But so there are not as many as they would like, as we would like, but they are mighty, and they do many, many different and wonderful things, whether it's communicable diseases or case managing a child in foster care, their medical needs, or home visiting for a recently delivered pregnant mom who's got high-risk conditions for herself or the baby. There's many, many ways in which our nurses are just doing amazing things, so shout out to them. And that will be followed next week by National EMS Week. And we will be doing a presentation at the Board of Supervisors to update them on the EMS system. We haven't done that in a little bit of time, as well as giving some recognition to some of our EMS heroes. So that is happening next Tuesday at the board on May 17th. I wish I could tell you if it was morning or afternoon. I don't think we know that yet. The agenda usually settles out around this time, but so stay tuned if you're interested in joining us. And the county recommended budget is due out very shortly for the fiscal year that will begin July 1st. I don't think I can give you any real spoilers, but the recommended budget that will go to the board for the budget hearings in June, I feel very optimistic about. We, as you know, went through about 7 years, the seven-year pain plan during the recession and beyond. We in public health lost about a third of our county general fund support during that time, and we have been slowly adding back, and I so some of it will be replacement of things that really took a disproportionate toll, like our public health nurses. And we're also really continuing to try to build on infrastructure and outward-facing efforts like policy development and communications and support for our soon-to-be electronic health records. So those are some of the areas, sneak preview, that I think will be recommended for some additional support in the coming year. As of May 1st, this is very exciting news for those who care about healthcare access for all of our residents. As of May 1st, all children, regardless of immigration status, now can enroll in full scope Medi-Cal. So that is a wonderful thing. It's up to about, and I don't know the exact number. It's up to about 225% of the federal poverty level. I don't know from whence that number comes, because it was always 250 for the regular population, but I mentioned these things so I can go home and do my homework. And I'll have that figured out by the next time I make such an announcement. But the May, it's already in place, and the good news is that folks will be able to have necessary health care paid for. The bad news is we're not sure if there's going to be enough access for the demand that will come, and particularly we're seeing that in oral health care. We are going to continue to work with our Oral Health Coalition and our stakeholders about how we can expand access to care. It's a great thing that there's a lot more demand being put on the system, that folks can eventually get their children in to see the dentist, but they are having to wait quite a bit longer because the numbers with insurance cards, the number of providers has not kept pace with the number of children that now have a means of payment. So stay tuned on that. I know it's an area of great interest for the commission and for me as well. And there may be a state opportunity. We're planning on throwing our hat in the ring. 15 counties will be funded out of a state grant for expansion of oral health access in the coming year. So stay tuned, and that's it for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I just had a question about the oral health availability. Is it because there aren't enough dentists here, or is it because there aren't enough dentists that will accept Medi-Cal?
Both. So our two main safety net providers that will accept Dentical, the dental portion of your Medi-Cal benefits, Tolosa Children's Dental Health, and community health centers, they, I think, are both recruiting for additional dentists, and they have long wait lists. They also, I think, are both bumping up against physical capacity for the number of dental chairs and operatories. So I think they're both looking at that to some extent. And of course, the access problem would be solved if every dentist in the community would take Dentical, but the rates are not really going in very far, very fast. There is going to be a small increase in the coming year, but I'm not sure if that's going to be able to support any new dentists to get into the Dentical system. If you look at the, you know, this is the same way in healthcare. You get a provider directory. It looks like there's 50 dentists that accept Dentical, and it's really about three that you can actually get an appointment with, and that might be some months in the future. So, yeah, you know, this has been an issue in this county for quite a long time, and we were doing much better. One of the big things that happened that decreased the number of providers accepting Dentical is when the expanded children's health insurance program known as Healthy Families got folded into Medi-Cal, and the Dentical rates then got applied to those families that that resulted in many fewer dentists available to see these families. So.
Thank you. Any questions?
I had a question. It used to be that the federally qualified health centers used to recruit dentists out of their training, and very similar to the National Health Corps. But we had to be designated as a underserved area, and I know that kind of went away in some areas of the county, in fact, most of the county. Is that ever a possibility for dental recruitment?
So let me make sure I'm clear on your question. So licensed dentists who's completed their training,
it was a way of offsetting their
loan repayment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was a loan repayment for their.
The loan repayment program is still in place. You have to show dental shortage areas. I believe that there is one somewhere in the Atascadero area, or there was. I used to get an announcement of that. I haven't seen it in a bit, but
so it has to still be an overall dental shortage based on the number of dentists rather than those that are serving SenCal?
I believe so,
gotcha.
Yeah. And for dentistry, SenCal isn't. They're involved for preventive services through the pediatrician, like fluoride, okay, varnish, and some things, but Dentical remains a fee-for-service paid by the state directly for most dental services.
Okay.
Yeah, you don't need to, you know, CHC can expand their scope of dental practice however they want, but it probably requires some bricks and mortars and recruitment and so, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Bornstein. That really was an exciting report. We're glad to hear the budget is more in our favor these years. It was a long time coming back. Commissioner reports. Start with Commissioner Kingston Barker.
No report.
Ditto.
I only have one. Heal Slow will have their quarterly meeting later this week. They are planning I believe it's a 10-year anniversary celebration meeting, whatever. The temporary agenda is available. They'll be firming that up, but mark your calendars for Friday, October the 7th, I believe.
No report from here.
No report.
The tobacco control program and the sheriff's department recently conducted stings in the unincorporated area in the North County. They looked at 51 stores, and there were 4 stores that sold to minors and 2 stores that were not licensed to sell. Those stores will appear in court. There'll be at least $1,000 fine for each one of those stores. These stings have been certainly successful because when they first started these in 2014, the percentage was 26%, and now it's down to 8%. This last sting was 8%, which is a good trend.
And the report that I...
Oh, I'm sorry. If the chair
ahead,
would
Dr.
allow
Bernstein.
Me to jump in on the subject of tobacco, because I went like this when you spoke. There is some really groundbreaking news in the tobacco control arena this week, and I just wanted to make sure that we all knew about it. 4 bills signed by the governor, very substantial. One is to make e-cigarettes fall under the same regulatory authority in the state of California as other tobacco products. The second is to raise the age of sale to age 21. The third is to close some loopholes in the licensing and sales. And the fourth is to make all school properties tobacco-free. So this was really kind of monumental in the tobacco control industry, and I didn't want to lose that opportunity. And thank you for Commissioner Warren for letting me jump in.
Does that include colleges?
I don't believe so, but we'll check.
Thank you. Did you have a report, Commissioner?
Yes,
Warren?
I did, from the Homeless Services Oversight Council, and they are still working together on a lot of exciting projects coming up, collaborations and things about trying to find extra housing. But the other piece that they're starting very early on is what was discussed tonight on the point in time count. And they're going to start looking for and training volunteers early, so that and they've got some new questions. They're really trying to streamline questions, so people, like he talked about with the question about, are you a veteran, finding different ways to be a lot more user-friendly. And so I'll have more information probably after their next meeting as to, you could contact Laurel Weir, W-E-I-R, at the Department of Social Services, and she's heading off that point in time count. But anybody in the community that's interested in going out for that one morning where we survey and try to find where all the homeless are so that we get that snapshot of how many we have. will be invited to participate in that. So.
Okay, thank you, commissioners. The committee reports, budget, legislative, no. But we do know community education had a meeting, and are you who's reporting on that?
Probably would have been Jean.
Yeah.
She chaired the meeting, and she's not here tonight. I had a few notes, but I can send them out. But basically, they met, and they discussed some actions on ways to establish communication pathways with the board. A few things that they want to do or talked about doing was improve the Health Commission webpage a bit. I'm going to start by making some small changes to that and work with Jennifer Shea on improving the new webpage that they're that's going to be coming soon. And then we're going to try to list the topics discussed at the meetings on the webpage. And we're also going to try to make it easier for the public to be able to contact commissioners where to submit questions and comments or topic suggestions. And also looking at ways to improve public awareness of the Health Commission, we're going to include Health Commission meeting announcements in county e-newsletter and add announcements of Health Commission meetings to Public Health Bulletin and post messages on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And there were some further considerations that talked about maybe submitting an annual report to the Board of Supervisors and presenting recommendations at Board of Supervisor meetings and forming task force work groups of interested commissioners to dive deeper into some issues. Those were some of the things that came out of the meeting.
Sounds like it was a very productive meeting. Okay, well, thank you, everybody who participated in that. I wanted to get there and somehow didn't manage to make it, unfortunately. Okay, so we're on to prospective future items. We did have a request from...
Nominating.
Oh, I'm sorry, there is nominating.
So we will bring a suggested executive committee list, or our officers, as we call them, to the commission next meeting, which is in June. So if anyone would like to nominate anyone, we have three positions, chair, vice chair, and secretary, I think. If anyone would like to nominate anyone, we would like to hear from them. You can email Jean, if you will accept for us, please, Jean. We'll be meeting hopefully by the end of this month, which is just a couple of weeks away, so to hear from you soon. We also, hopefully next month, will bring a recommendation to fill our one vacancy on the commission.
Thank you. Now, prospective future items. there was obviously some interest from the public on air quality in the South County, and they asked us to agendize that item. We do have our planning meeting in July where we make a list of programs that we're planning on for the year, both educational and specifically for issues that people want us to address. So I would suggest that be considered. I think we have an agenda already, a program for next month. And so I think that would be a subject to take up at our July meeting as to how we would want to have that as an agenda item. Any comments on that? Any comments on future meetings? Okay. Well, I think that ends another episode of the Health Commission in San Luis Obispo County. So this meeting is adjourned.